podcast for the best and worst historical fiction has to offer. I'm your host, Grace.
And I'm Erin, and each week we'll be reading a different historical fiction book to see if they're a five or a flop.
Our season two theme is book talk and bestsellers, and this week we are throwing it back a little but not that much, reading Half of a Yellow Sun by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
And before we get into all of that, let's catch up with each other. Not like I didn't see you this week already, but Grace, what's new?
Well, last time we spoke to the pod listeners, I was about to move, and now I have completely moved.
Okay.
Yes, so everything is in. Most of the strenuous work is done, so I am happy to be over with all of that and have it all settled and to be in the new place.
She built furniture by herself.
Yes.
Very impressed.
And by built furniture, we are referring to IKEA furniture.
Hey, it's better than nothing.
So don't get too excited. Erin helped. Thank you, Erin.
Hey, I did my best. I carried some stuff over. I loaded the moving van.
Most crucially, you bought me a sandwich.
Most crucially, I did. Okay, the key with moving is you need to have food on hand because you were going to run out of energy. And if you do, like, you're going to feel like you're going to pass out.
And I just knew, like, we luckily, generously had a lot of friends who were willing to help out. So we had a crew stationed at the old place and at the new place. And everyone was, like, ready to go when they were called upon. And so I don't want to, like, make everyone hold so I can go eat something. And I knew, like, I have to eat. Like, I knew about myself.
You have to eat during.
Like, you have to eat. Yeah. So honestly, the thing, though, that I'm most proud of is that I drove the U-Haul.
Yeah, that is very impressive. In D.C., that's not fun.
No. And it wasn't a huge one. It was not like a big box truck. It was just a cargo van.
Yeah. That's what Santiago and I did as well.
It's still very high up and wide, and the gear shift is weird.
And you can't see anything. You kind of just trust that, like, people around you are afraid.
Yeah. And hopefully they were. And I didn't hit anything, and it was fine. And it's honestly pretty cheap to get a U-Haul compared to, like, I don't know how much you think it might be.
Yeah.
It's certainly cheaper to rent a U-Haul than a car.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't bad at all.
So, other than that, Erin, what's up with you?
So, I've been getting into running. Like every other DC person, I've been getting into running. I kind of hate it. It's actually getting to the point where it's not the most miserable part of my day anymore.
That's amazing.
It's not the best part. It's not even a good part, but it's not miserable. I've, like, worked through most of the pain. Like, I don't really feel in pain when I run anymore. I did just achieve my best 5K time,
Woo! Which
is a 13-minute mile pace, which any of our listeners, if you're runners, you know that is really bad. But we're getting there.
But also, you're going to run a 10K soon.
I did. I signed up for a 10K with Santiago and Hannah. Y'all will meet Hannah shortly. Conrad might be doing it as well. These are all people in our friend group. I'm talking like you know them. But yeah, so a 10K, that's coming up in May 19th with, actually, I'm not sure when this episode premieres, so I may have already run my 10K by then.
Probably. No.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, congratulations, future me, for having run a 10K, maybe. I'm pretty excited. As long as I keep around a 12, 13-minute mile, I'll be proud of myself.
Oh, yeah.
Which is more running than walking.
It's what we say about the flop books. Like, even if it's the biggest flop in the world, at least you wrote a book.
Yeah, right?
Even if it's the slowest 10K, you ran a 10K.
Exactly. It's going to be the cartographer's secret of 10Ks. Yeah, getting excited for that. But in the meantime, I've been doing some reading.
Yes, this was disappointing for me to hear. Tell me about what you've been reading recently.
So, the other week when Grace and I finished up filming the podcast, we went upstairs to the rest of the library to look for some books. Grace was fortunate in what she found, and I thought I was fortunate. So as we know from past history, I love the Click series. Born and raised on it, love Massey Block. Lisey Harrison was like a second mother to me as a child. However, she came out with an adult book, and it's called The Dirty Book Club.
Which I feel like sounds like a promising title for a fun book that you could read on the beach.
It was one of the worst books I've ever read. And I read the whole thing. It was a pretty quick read, so I was like, I'm not going to DNF this. It just, like, the plot lines didn't connect. There were just random things of, like, her trying to be funny, and it wasn't funny. None of the characters were likable. It was a hot fucking mess. The main character's parents were dead for I don't know what reason, except for she was afraid to drive a car.
Well, they are scary, especially if it's a U-Haul.
Well, yeah. But anyways, that was incredibly disappointing. Lisey Harrison maybe stick to writing young adult novels.
Yeah.
In 2005.
I guess you could read The Click and be like, yes, I can see how this person is not a good writer. But we hope for better. We also don't, like, a fun book is not always a good book.
Exactly.
But a fun book can be a bad book.
Yes.
So that's very unfortunate.
Which seemed to be the case here. I would not recommend this one.
Womp womp.
What have you been reading?
I dug into my little pile of like 50 cent used bookstore books and I pulled out The Best American Magazine Writing from the year 2001.
Oh.
Yes. Very niche. But I found, so now I've read Best American Magazine Writing. They still put them out. They put them out every single year. It's just like a big bound collection. And the first time I came across one, I was like, I love to read think pieces. Like, I should get that, you know. And honestly, it's very interesting because it takes you back to, like, a cultural moment.
Okay.
Especially one that, like, I was not a part of because I was, like, five.
Didn't have that much, consciousness.
No. But I will say, now having read Best American Magazine Writing 2001 and 2002, not on purpose, just because those are the ones that I found at my used bookstore, I expected one of them to be heavily 9/11 focused, and neither of them were.
Really?
Yeah. So I don't know if that was just like a newspaper thing and not a magazine thing.
Well, it makes you think back to like, and of course I don't remember seeing these live on air, but I've seen like on YouTube and stuff, the ads on Disney Channel at the time that were like super American. So it was kind of like everything, and like the whole genre of country music like kind of shifted at that point to be really like nationalistic.
Yeah.
So I feel like it was everything.
Well, also it was weird because the 2002 one had a plane crash story in it.
They wouldn't have cut that.
Well, it wasn't like they didn't mention 9/11. It wasn't even like, oh, this is what, you know, plane crash protocol was like prior to 9/11 and how it's different now. It just like didn't bring it up at all. So maybe it got punted down the road to 2003. But yeah, I was waiting for it and it never came. But I do like those collections. So if you frequent a used bookstore and you also like to read think pieces, they're real cheap. So just grab them.
Good to know. I will keep that in mind.
Yeah. Should we get into our book for this week?
Yes, we shall. I will start us off with the synopsis.
Please do.
Half of a Yellow Sun. With effortless grace, celebrated author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie illuminates a seminal moment in modern African history. Biafra's impassioned struggle to establish an independent republic in southeastern Nigeria during the late 1960s. We experience the tumultuous decade alongside five unforgettable characters. Sidebar, I wouldn't call them unforgettable.
Ooh.
Ogu, a 13-year-old houseboy who works for Odenibu, a university professor of revolutionary zeal. Olana, the professor's beautiful young mistress who abandoned her life in Lagos for a dusty town and her lover's charm. And Richard, a shy young Englishman infatuated with Olana's willful twin sister, Kanani. All right, so that is a
snapshot,
a very, very high level overview of what happens in this novel, which honestly, again, that's fine with me because we know I don't read the covers anyway. So this is what I want out of a cover.
That doesn't matter to you. And honestly, I appreciate this. I don't realize sometimes how long and involved book synopses are until we start reading them. And then I'm like, this is way too much information and it's taking me so long to read this out. So I do appreciate whoever wrote the synopsis was just like, here is the time period, the place, and the names of the people. Read it or don't.
That makes me think of Snowflower, and remember how we knew, like, immediately, basically, what was going to happen?
Yes.
Yeah. This is preferred.
And how the one for Song of Achilles that we found was basically just, like, this book is so beautiful, and Madeline Miller is a masterful author, and it said nothing about what it was about, so we had to find an alternate synopsis.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, enough about that. Tell me a little bit about our author, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
So yes, we actually have quite a bit to say about the author because there is a bit of controversy that we do feel we need to touch on.
Yes, so we'll do the bio stuff first like normal, and then we'll come back to that.
Okay. So our author was born in Nigeria, grew up on the campus of University of Nigeria, which I believe was where part of this book was set.
Yes.
Of the book fame, and she came to U.S. for school. Her first novel, Purple Hibiscus, in 2003, won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize, and her second novel, Half of a Yellow Sun, won the Orange Prize. I don't know if these are ones you're familiar with.
Well, Madeline Miller, Song of Achilles, won the Orange
Prize.
Oh,
you're right. I forgot about that.
And also, I had tricked myself in my head to thinking that Half of a Yellow Sun was the debut, so I'm glad to be corrected on that.
Yes. Her 2013 novel, Americana, won the U.S. National Book Critics Circle Award and was named one of the New York Times top 10 best books of 2013.
So actually, let's real quick say, this is going to come up with the next book that we read next episode, but also with this one, so we'll bring it up twice. Definitely, this author's most popular book is Americana.
Yes.
Our purpose for choosing Half of a Yellow Sun instead is so we could broaden our horizons for the season in terms of the countries represented.
Yes.
So we didn't want another America-focused book. So even though a lot of you might be more familiar with Americana, obviously Half of a Yellow Sun is still a very famous and well-known book.
Yes.
But it's set in Nigeria, so we've gone with this one.
Yes. So our author was also named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World in 2015. And in 2017, Fortune Magazine named her one of the world's 50 greatest leaders, which I was kind of surprised about. I don't think many authors get that title.
No, that's kind of crazy because I assume Fortune Magazine 50 greatest leaders would encompass like CEOs, obviously the Fortune 500, maybe political leaders, like, you know.
It's really cool to see an author represented.
Yeah. I mean, storytellers control so much of the way that we see our world. So I think that that's fitting to have writers on that list.
Okay, so now going into a bit more of the controversial area. So as a note, we try not to pick books or authors with controversies that we don't feel qualified to address in the span of our 40-minute to an hour-long podcast. But this one did slip through the cracks, and I had not forgotten about it, but I had forgotten about it a bit until I was doing the research for this. And I remember hearing about it, but I never truly delved deep into it.
Yes. It's been a while since this occurred. And normally we are able, I think, to more effectively filter through, like Erin said, things we're not comfortable addressing ourselves when it's tied to the work itself.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an issue that is not really related to the contents of Half of a Yellow Sun or Purple Hibiscus or Americana. So in that way, we had selected the book and read it and prepped for it before we realized, oh, this is something else that we need to talk about in the pod.
So Adichie had made some transphobic remarks in the past, implying that trans women aren't real women. She also came to the defense of J.K. Rowling more recently. And there was an article that she wrote discussing two of her former students who had criticized her remarks.
And both of these former students are themselves published authors and pretty well known.
Mm-hmm. In choosing this book for the pod and after having done our research, we're trying to find a balance between how influential this book has been on its own versus acknowledging the author's remarks as something that we do not agree with and we do not stand by.
Mm-hmm.
So we just wanted to bring that to your awareness. We're going to leave the links to the articles and some of the research we had done in the bio that you can take a look at after listening to this episode, just for you to be aware that this was not something we had entirely prepped for going into the book, but want to make sure is addressed now.
Yes, and we're not going to gloss over it. It does seem it's very unfortunate when something like this happens, when someone whose work is so important and so smart in one area shows a real blindness in another and says things that are very inappropriate. And it does seem like when she came to the defense of J.K. Rowling that she was really doubling down on comments beforehand that were problematic, but not to that level of hate. Like you'd think, oh, maybe you could be pulled back from this.
Yeah, maybe.
But it seems she was only further radicalized, which is really, really unfortunate. And I hope that you will read the Vox article and whatever else we might link in the comments or in the description for this episode. But again, we just want to emphatically state that we think trans women are women on this podcast.
Yes.
And we feel very lucky to be cis women and to be sisters with trans women.
Yes.
So maybe we should.
Thank you for putting it so eloquently.
That's all you need to say. And that's all that she needed to say when she was asked. And it's very sad that she chose not to.
Yeah, it's very sad she doubled down on that. In the meantime, have you read anything else by this author, or are you familiar with this book beforehand?
No, actually, I have not read anything before of hers.
I thought you had read Americana. Was I wrong?
No. Actually, there is a copy of Americana in our now old house
that
someone else was reading. And then one of our roommates was like, oh, Grace, I knew you would love that book. And I was like, I have no idea because it's not mine. Yeah. Americana was the only book that I'd heard of. Okay. I wasn't familiar with Half of a Yellow Sun or Purple Hibiscus before.
Okay.
But I was definitely aware not only of Americana, but also of We Should All Be Feminists, which is her. I think there's a little book published with that title by her. I think she had a TED Talk that blew up from that name. So I'm familiar with her and her kind of general feminist shtick, but I'm not... I feel like, sorry, that's reductive to call it a shtick. That's, you know.
Yeah,
I know what you mean. But I was not familiar with her writing, even though I knew she was a writer.
Yeah, so I had actually read this book before. This was another reread for me.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. I read this summer after my freshman year of college. It had been recommended to me. I think my freshman year roommate recommended it to me.
Okay.
Wish she hadn't, if that's going to lead you into my thoughts on this book.
Wait, so is this the only one you've read?
Yes. Okay. I do really want to read Americana, though. I had not heard of Purple Hibiscus before.
Yeah. Well, I guess then that makes sense that it's the debut. Mm-hmm. Even though clearly it won, you know, awards and was a big deal and got her more book deals, and now she is who she is.
Yes.
So.
And just our brief disclaimer, as usual, our judgments come based on the books and characters within them rather than any real historical figures they may have been based on, and also spoilers ahead. This book has been out for quite a number of years now, so...
And also you've maybe seen the movie, which is apparently not good.
Apparently the movie is terrible.
Okay. I will say, though, Erin told me, we even dropped this as a hint in one of our earlier episodes as to what book this was... Erin said, Grace, did you know that there's a movie of Half of a Yellow Sun? And I said, no. And she said, supposedly it's terrible. And I was like, oh my God. And then I looked it up and it's like the most star-studded movie. Like every name in it. Yeah, it's the main character, Oda Nebo, is Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Oh my God.
Of the lead role of 12 Years a Slave fame.
Jesus.
And like consistently working since then. Olana, I believe, is Tandy Newton, very famous.
Oh my God.
And then this movie came out in 2013. Uga, who is the young boy, is John Boyega from Star Wars.
Oh, Star Wars fame.
Pre-Star Wars. Yeah, so it was like, oh my God.
This
is
insane. But even looking at the movie poster, and now we're going on a tangent, and from what the reviews I've heard, because I've not seen it, is that they really, like, hone in on the romance.
That's
and
so...
And if you look at the cover of it, that, like, I would... think there was no war in this.
Oh my gosh. Well, then that's to say, I guess, clearly that if, and it sounds like it is, if the Half of a Yellow Sun movie was bad, then it is not the fault of the actors, because they have top tier people for
that. They have a great cast. It's kind of like how Twilight had an incredible cast and just like, everyone was like, oh my God, Kristen Stewart can't act, but it was just because the script was like not good.
Because she was doing as directed and what was directed was poor.
Yeah. So I do want to watch that movie. That might be a fun bonus episode coming up.
Yeah. We're going to have to be choosy about what we watch for bonus episodes.
There's so many shows.
We have a lot of options.
You know what we're going to have to do for bonus? Bridgerton.
Oh my gosh. I can't. Listen, it's not like we're watching Bridgerton for this. It's that we're going to watch Bridgerton and then we can also get a bonus episode out of it.
Exactly.
We're
going to talk about it anyway.
They're kind of in that stage of, this will give you a hint as to when we're recording this. They're kind of in that stage of promo for Bridgerton where they'll drop like a 10-second Instagram video like every other day. And it's getting me ready. I eat them all up.
Yes, because we are filming this in advance, Grace and I are going to soon have a rewatch of seasons one and two, or first time watch of season one for Grace.
First time watch of season one.
Insane to me. But.
Rewatch of season two.
Okay, so now let's get into the book, now that we're off a side tangent.
Now that we're done talking about movies and Bridgerton, let's talk about the Biafran War.
Can we start by you guessing what my least favorite part of this book was?
Was it the sexual assault part?
Can we start by you guessing what my second least favorite part of this book was?
Okay, that requires more thought.
From, like, a structural standpoint?
Oh, was it that you go forward in time and then back again?
It's the time jump. I didn't like it. I didn't think it was necessary.
It definitely... I didn't have a problem with it, per se. I do like how this season is kind of turning into, like, who has the best executed time skips.
Honestly, I did not expect it.
There's been some good ones. There's been some bad ones. I think that this was not one of the best, but it was okay with me because it only happened two times?
Yeah, it was...
Not a lot.
I'm starting here because I do think it's important to the structure of the book.
Yes.
So it's basically you start in...
It goes from the early
60s. Back to early.
Yes. Early 60s, late 60s, early 60s.
Yes. And I think that's important for context. But for me, I hated it. And that was probably one of my biggest downsides of this. Actually, I had a lot of downsides of this book. But this was one of my biggest.
What specifically about it didn't you like? Did it just like throw you out of rhythm? Like, what was the deal?
I thought it was cheap writing.
Mm.
I thought it jumped ahead to be like, oh, all these mystery things, like, oh, she has a baby now. Like, oh, why is Richard's relationship so tense with them now? I thought it was cheap to build suspense.
Okay, so you think it was, like, unearned?
Yeah. Okay. It didn't work for me because I thought it was too fake.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting. I feel like some of that I get, like, when you flash forward to the future and Richard has been banned from their house and you're like, ooh, why?
Yeah.
But even some of it I didn't realize was supposed to be setting up a reveal until the reveal happened. And then I was like, whoa. Like when they have the baby. I'm just like, okay, like 10 years
that,
have passed.
Okay, I agree with that.
They probably just have a baby. But then they're being all weird about the baby, and I don't know. So
the baby one was the only one.
Yeah. I did not mind the time skip. I did appreciate, because this was my problem. And again, I acknowledged in that episode that this was a me problem and not an Anthony Dora problem. Mm-hmm. But in All the Light We Cannot See, the time jumps were to specific years. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated in this book that they just kind of did away with that. That it was just like early 60s, late 60s.
Yeah, that's fair.
I can't juggle all that. Then it would have been too much. Because I already couldn't handle the All the Light We Cannot See ones.
So that's the biggest structural thing to know going into this novel, is that it does have that flip. So if when we're describing the plot a little bit, we get a bit jumbled timeline-wise, mm-hmm. that's why.
Yes. I mean, it's certainly that this was structured very purposefully. I feel like sometimes if you're reading a book with a lot of time jumps in it, sometimes it feels like the author wrote it all in sequence and then chopped it up and then moved the pieces around.
Yeah.
Like there was clear intention here. So that's, you know, at least there's that, even if you go in and maybe it doesn't work for you, maybe it mm-hmm. does. You can tell we have not the most dramatic difference of opinion that we've ever had, but we have a difference of opinion.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly. So I think other than that, the next most important thing to put on the table is to talk about the five main characters.
Yes.
You have three point of view characters, but for all intents and purposes, there are five main characters.
Yes.
And two of them you just don't get a POV for.
Which is good and bad for me, because one was the character I really liked and one was the character I really didn't like. So.
Okay. So let's talk about who I think we both agree might be the best character who is not the POV character.
Oh, yeah.
Who is Kainani.
Oh, yeah. Loved her.
Yes. She is very much, if this book was a little less serious and sad, Kainani would be such a popular character for the genre of person who is like, this is for the eldest daughters who were a pleasure to
have
in class.
Absolutely.
She's a twin. Her sister is Olana, who I also loved.
I loved her.
We'll get into a little bit later what I loved about Olana so much, but I have a note here that I was like, let's talk about Lakshmi, let's talk about Violetta, let's talk about Olana. Like, I put her in that category.
I would too.
And Olana is the beautiful one, the effortless one, the wealthy one, the popular one, the Serena Vanderwoodson, if you will.
Oh, yeah. She's so true.
And Kainani is the older one, the serious one, the one who's in business, the one who always knows that even if she doesn't feel that she is in the shadow of Olana, she knows that other people feel that way.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So for all intents and purposes, she is.
Yes.
She has a lot of complexity that I think it works in the book's favor that you're not examining up close.
Mm-hmm.
I think it works that you're not in her head, even though you want to be. Maybe even during some of the other parts when you're in the male characters' heads and you're like, God, I hope Kainani's doing okay. Mm-hmm. I wish I was up with her instead. But she was a very strong part of this book. You can, reading Olana and reading Kainani, you really can tell, even though unfortunately it doesn't extend to all women, that Adichie is like, has this very prominent feminist advocacy in history. Because these are excellent female characters.
And it's interesting because I almost, you know, when we talked about A Land Remembered and also several other books where we're like, some male authors cannot write women.
Yes.
I don't think Adichie can write men.
That's
my
interesting
hot take.
That is, you know what? I don't know that I disagree with you. Because really, when you think about it, she didn't do it that much. The other two, so the central character around which all of these characters almost like rotate, like he's the sun and they're the planets, is Oda Nebo.
Mm-hmm.
He's the professor. Everyone is tangentially related to him in some kind of way.
And he's the other character without a POV.
You don't get his POV, which I think works because he is supposed to be like that anchor.
Yeah, that worked for me really well.
Yes, I agree. And then the other two characters that you get the point of view for, you get Olana's,
mm-hmm.
you get Uga's, mm-hmm. and he is really less so writing a man and more a boy because he's a child.
He's in kind of that puberty to adolescence
age. When you get him, he's between 9 and 15 or 16 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And really that focus is on seeing things from a perspective of someone who is growing, who doesn't necessarily understand everything that he sees.
He is also the one that doesn't come from like the wealthy, high status background.
Yes. He's their servant child, essentially. And then you get Richard's point of view, who is an Englishman, mm-hmm. who is, you know, in Nigeria, in Biafra through the whole conflict. And almost, you're right, I think that she's using him not necessarily to write a male point of view, but really to write a white point of view. Like, yeah. that's, him being male is necessary from a plot standpoint, but it's not, I think, the thing that Adichie is interested in.
No, I agree with that. And I think, I do think the white it feels weird to say, like, it added, like, a good bit, but I do think it gave a better understanding of, like, that colonizer, white savior point of view. And yeah. I think that was an asset in this book.
Well, it's exactly what, I think Richard is a great example of a character who, when people say, like, it's so necessary to have characters that do bad things or aren't good people.
Yeah.
Because it expands your understanding of the real world. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not a person that you want to spend time with. And I think the thing that's so masterful about Richard is he's not, like, a malicious, evil person.
Yes.
He just is a person who, like, he doesn't feel at home in England. And so when he's in Nigeria, he is tangential to the central characters because he's in a relationship with Kainani. Mm-hmm. And he is in Nigeria when the Biafran Civil War, when the Nigerian Civil War breaks out, and they're building this new country. Mm-hmm. And his first thing is, oh, I've been here since day one. I can be Biafran.
Yes.
And that's his taking something that's not his, even through completely unviolent means, just like saying those words, is the purpose of why he's there.
Yes.
And it takes him until the very end of the book to realize, like, I'm not Biafran and I will never be.
And to realize that is not his story to tell. His whole thing is he's trying to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole way through the book, you get little, like, excerpts at the end of his POV with,
and, like, the book is called The World Was Silent While We Died.
Yes.
And we is crucial there, while we died. Yeah.
But at the end, it's revealed that it's not Richard's book, it's Uga's book.
Yes, which was great.
Which I really liked that. Yeah. I liked that it wasn't Richard's. I'm glad he finally learned this lesson of, it's not my story to tell.
And it is really satisfying narratively and just from, like, a global, like, hope perspective to have this child who was, like, literally fighting in the armed struggle to grow up and survive, and you're like, he's, like, leading in the next generation yeah. of Nigerians, and he will make sure that people remember this conflict and that they will feel bad about not doing anything mm-hmm. to help, essentially.
Should we get into how fucking messy all their relationships are?
Oh my gosh.
One of my notes is literally, damn, they say cheating in this book, and for what purpose?
They really, no one was faithful to anyone except Kainani.
So yeah, except her, honestly.
Except the queen.
Love
except
her.
The best character. Yeah.
Olana and Odenigbo are in a relationship.
Yes.
They're not, it's like a big thing that they're not married.
Let me say real quick, this is something that bothered me so much when I was reading. And it's a minor thing, but it really stuck in my craw. That the synopsis refers to Olana as Odenigbo's mistress. She's his girlfriend.
Like, yeah.
To me, that the word mistress is not a dirty word, but it has a certain connotation.
Oh, yeah.
Like, but they're equal partners in this relationship.
Yeah, they're just dating.
Odenigbo wants to marry her, and she says no. She wants to maintain a shred of that independence.
Yeah.
Which is good for her, because then he cheats on her later.
And he cheats on her with his mother's servant, who winds up having the child that is baby. They call the child baby.
Yes.
And Olana winds up, like, adopting the baby as her own. I said, another win for Olana. Parentheses, unsurprising.
Yeah, I mean, she is just at every turn, even when she's not being, like, a perfect model person, she was so strong and real, and, like, I just could, like, sense that she was such a person. Like, not just a character. She was a person, and I really, really loved being with her.
Yes.
But the other cheating is Olana sleeps with Richard, which is to get back at Odenigbo for cheating on mm-hmm. her, which in and of itself, I would be like, fine, whatever, manage it anyway. But of course, you remember Richard is Kainani's boyfriend, and that's her twin sister. So really, they, all three of them, understand it to be a betrayal of Kainani
yeah.
when they sleep together. And that's another kind of moment where, not quite to the level of Song of Achilles, but in that book, we were like, Patroclus sleeps with Achilles' wife, and for what reason? Yeah. Like, he doesn't want to, like, there's no buildup, yeah, like, exactly. It just happens. In this book, you're like, okay, Olana has these feelings of, like, wanting to get revenge on Odinibo for cheating on her. Richard sucks, so you're not really surprised, you know? And it's also that classic thing of a very beautiful woman comes onto a man, and he's, like, wants his ego stroked, and he's not going to say no. But
Kainani is such a bad bitch, though. When she found out about it, she, like, took Richard's manuscript that he'd been slaving away at it and burned it page by page.
Yes. And then after that, she was just like, we're even now. Like, she wasn't even mad anymore, really. Like, she didn't talk to her sister still. But she was just like, by the way, I destroyed your book. And then we just won't talk about it again.
I loved that.
Yeah.
I love that she wasn't the typical, like, how you see authors portray, like, a woman freaking out over that. Like, I like how she...
Yeah.
Had a different sense of reaction, because it's like, in some ways, like, they're taking things they love from each other.
Yeah. It was a good representation of something realistic, toxic, but not, like, cartoonishly so.
Yeah.
This was obviously, like, a bit literary. Like, the way that it wraps up that neatly is not necessarily how you would see something like that in real life.
But that's okay.
But I think that as something, like, obviously in a book, it worked very well.
So, going to the other characters, I really didn't like anyone but Olana and Kainani, but not in a way that you can still like bad characters. Like, you can like a character who is bad, does bad things. I just didn't like these characters. Mm-hmm. I appreciated the different perspectives and experiences of the war, but for the emotional connections it wanted us to make with them, the other characters really fell flat for me. Like, I could only make that emotional connection with Olana and Kainani.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the other big issue with this book is for me, is that it tries to walk the line between military war book and emotional interpersonal book by focusing on the characters. But that balance is never struck for me.
Okay. Do you think it did too much of one or the other? Or just that, like, the way it was distributed was inappropriate?
Kind of I wish I could put it into better words. I feel like I wanted it to be more in one camp than the other. I feel like it was almost trying to be too heavy on interpersonal relationships with characters who were not fleshed out.
Mm-hmm. I will say, this kind of leads me into another point that I have, which is, I don't think that the character of Ugga, the young, poor houseboy, is really used correctly or not... used correctly, but the way that Adichie is using him, I don't think is effective or necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, so we have these three POV characters. Olana is the main one of the three. Certainly, we spend the most time with her. And she's fabulous, and we love her.
Mm-hmm.
Richard, whether or not you enjoy reading his sections, which it seems like, you know, you definitely didn't.
No.
And I did. I thought they were solid. We definitely agree that he's there for a purpose.
Yeah.
And you can, like, when you're reading it, you can see, like, obviously what that purpose is. Ugga, he's a younger person, so he comes from that perspective. He has a poor background. The other characters are middle class, upper class, wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
All of them are educated. And he also, a little later in the book, he gets conscripted into the army.
Yes. Basically, like, picked off the street.
Yes. And even, frankly, at that point, I was like, you fucking deserve it. Because there were four separate scenes, I think, of Olana being like, don't go outside because they're conscripting boys your age. And he was like, okay. And then he went outside anyway. And he was like in the process of getting dragged off. And then they would like run over and use some connection to get him let go. And so this happened multiple times. And so finally I was like, well, then you just deserve it. Like,
yeah, if you're going to keep freaking doing this after you've been told not to, like, you've clearly seen the risks.
Yeah. And so at that point, towards the end of the book when he's conscripted, there are those frontline scenes where he's fighting or, you know, he's doing training, he's sleeping in camps, he has guns, he's doing all of this. But it comes so late in the game that it doesn't feel needed. And frankly, also, the civilians are, they're refugees, they're displaced, they're starving, there's bombings, there's shootings, we see the men being conscripted by just being grabbed off the street. All of that's happening, and it's so horrific, and I feel like so easily illustrates the horrors of the war, which is clearly the point, and also the point of what these battle scenes are supposed to do, but I don't think you need it. Like, we all know the mechanics of fighting a war.
Yeah, like, and I think that's why in this section we're not really going into the details of it, because we're going to cover so much of that in the history section.
Yeah, it's pretty glossed over in the book. You're not getting a ton of it. and there's not anything like unique to the terrain that would, you know, alter our perceptions of how the fighting is going. Like, it seems like pretty standard fighting.
Yeah.
So I don't think we needed that. I think that the character of Uga is the least strong and least important of the POVs.
He also had the section in it.
The sexual assault.
Yeah, the sexual assault section. So let's talk about that briefly. And we're not going to go into details because it's not something I'm comfortable going into a lot of details about. But there is a scene where Agu and other soldiers with him gang rape a girl in a bar.
Yes. And it's extremely graphic. Mm-hmm. And again, this is it's hard line to walk because I feel like we do this a lot where we criticize a scene like this in a book. And it's never a scene that is out of place in terms of the narrative.
No, like it felt realistic.
Yeah, you're like, of course that would happen. But what it made me think is, what is this supposed to do for our emotional attachment to Uga? Because it makes us hate him.
That's exactly what I had too. I'm like, this is a character we're supposed to, at this point of time, have had built some attachment to that's supposed to carry through the end. And I had to skim over the rest of his second. And like, I'd read the book before. I know this
you
is just
it.
The one scene. I knew it was coming. But still, it's like, I can't tolerate reading after this.
Well, and coupled with two other things, one before and one after, which for me were, his sections were so full of sex obsession before.
Oh my God. Because it was like the part of Chintu at the beginning when they're just talking about how much Chintu fucks.
Yeah. Like, I mean, and again, he's supposed to be a character going through puberty. So there is that. But it's a lot. So you're like, you're kind of like, it must be exhausting to be in your head, man. Like, if this is the way that you're thinking all of the time. And then also after he goes home after the devastation to see if that his family's alive, mm-hmm. and his sister is in this horrible depression and won't look at him and won't be alone with him. And a relative says, oh, it's because a bunch of soldiers came and gang raped her.
Yeah.
And he's like, how can I live with myself knowing I did that to someone else? And it's like, well, I don't care how you live.
Yeah,
with
I don't
yourself.
Care how you.
And it's again. She's trying to show us how, because he was in a group, he didn't feel like he had a choice. But I don't think that was communicated effectively enough. And it's just the discomfort of reading that scene where there's nothing else. Everything in the book, especially in the back half, is horrible.
Yeah, there's a lot of horrific scenes, but some of which we're going to get into in the history section.
Yeah, but those two things, they don't match tone, really. No. Everything else is like awful, but you can read it.
Yeah.
That is one thing where you're just like, oh,
yeah, that really, like, the character was already not a good character for me, and then it just became intolerable to read.
Yeah, so I think we would rank the same where we think Uga is not successful in his position in the story. Richard, we probably differ the most on that because I enjoyed reading his chapters.
I didn't enjoy it, but I do. But we understand both, his role.
We both get why he's there. And it works. It works why he's there.
Yeah.
And then we love Alana.
We love Alana. We love Kainani.
Odonibo.
Odonibo. Not really a fan of. He just, like, there wasn't much depth when reading him.
I'm not, like, attached to him. Same. Like, I understand. But I think I understand him.
He worked as an anchor. I really think this book could have just been the four characters, though. But even then, I was still emotionally connecting with half of them when the bulk of this book is supposed to be about their interpersonal relationships, and I just did not get into it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I also feel like towards the back of the book, the Olana-Odonibo relationship, which is the central one, drops because he's like, he's checked out. He does not react to the trauma of the Biafran War as well as Olana does. Like, she has this, like, live however possible, continue, like,
she
force myself
a teacher,
on.
Yeah,
like, she's, you know, not in a good place, but she's making it happen, and he's not making it happen. So that partnership, even when they're, you know, going through their ups and downs and cheating on each other, and he wants to get married and she doesn't, and they're trying to have a child and it doesn't happen and all of that, you still feel that there's a pull. There's a partnership there. There's a connection, even if they're fraying at it. Later, I don't feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that.
Is there anything else you want to hit on before we get into the history? Because I do think the history comprises a lot of the stuff we've skimmed over so far, which is the actual war.
I just want to wrap up and say I like this book. I thought there were a lot of little moments that really solidified how good of an experience it was for me. I liked the sprinkling in of the Igbo language. Mm-hmm. I liked the way that even there were parts that were written in English, but they were pretty stilted. And you were like, oh, this is how someone who doesn't primarily speak English would talk. I thought that was really authentic feeling and really nice. I really enjoyed the discussion of the different ethnic minorities. Mm-hmm. There was like even a brief part about like, well, if Biafra becomes an independent country, then there will be no massacres anymore. And then all of the smaller minorities were like, we know that's not true. Mm-hmm. I will say the same thing that we said about All the Light We Cannot See and Pachinko, which is this is a topic I knew very little about, and I'm happy that the book taught me more of it. I don't think it did so in as much detail as something like Pachinko, but I don't think it was trying to either, so I'm not going to ding that. I think it was trying to tell me the outline of the story by getting mm-hmm. across emotional moments, and I think it did that very well. And I'm very excited for you to tell me more, because I think from what I can see here in the doc, I think you've done a really good, thorough research job.
Thank you. It's because I did it while I was at the office and I didn't want to be working.
And you were done watching Young Sheldon.
And I was actually a non-Young Sheldon day when I
were totally focused.
We'll save Young Sheldon for another episode. What you just said segues us really nicely into the historical accuracy section, because this book is widely regarded as many people around the world's first introduction to the Biafran conflict, mine as well. My introduction may have been a few years ago when I first read this book, but still. So the author drew on eyewitness accounts from family, friends, and neighbors who lived throughout the war, and says that almost every single incident in this novel is based on something real.
That's crazy. Yeah, I saw that because it was in the author's note in the back. And when I saw that, I was like, I'm not surprised, but that's very sad. And also shows good attention to research and detail.
Agreed. And I like that she got the eyewitness accounts. Like, I think that adds a level of authenticity we don't see in a lot of historical fiction, because a lot of times it's not possible to get.
Yeah, and dedication to telling, like, an important story correctly.
One incident in the book that is very tragic, but is one of these examples. There was a scene where Olana is talking to this woman. I believe they were on a bus, I don't remember. And she was carrying her daughter's decapitated head in a basket. Mm-hmm. And she was like, spent so long on these braids. Like, do you see how pretty they are? It was very sad.
Mm-hmm. And that's a moment that Olana comes back to several times throughout the book.
So it was very prevalent. But the Nigerian Civil War lasted from 1967 to 1970s. The Igbos declared Biafra when they felt they could no longer coexist with the Muslim Hausa Fulanis. So it was an ethnic conflict. So along with the Vietnam War, this was one of the first wars to be televised for a global audience, which is kind of makes me feel really gross to even say, like, globalized for an audience. But...
Mm-hmm.
It was very, like, this was a war people could see it was happening.
Yeah.
So the UK and the USSR supported Nigeria, while France and Israel, which I was interested that Israel popped up as a main supporter of Biafra, but they were comparing the humanitarian crisis at the time in this war to the Holocaust.
And it's been only 20 years since the Holocaust.
So it was very new. It was very, very recent. And then this war has resulted in the continuing political marginalization of the Igbos. So even though Biafra reunited with Nigeria, there's still a lot of that marginalization going on.
Yeah. I mean, and this is this is the 60s. So it firmly counts as historical fiction.
Yes.
But you think about, like, again, there are people who live through this. Those prejudices aren't just going to go away in this span of time from then until now. It's not a lot of time.
And basically, this war was a result of colonialism, big shocker, which caused the three largest ethnic groups in the area, the Igbos, the Hausas, and the Yorubas, to be combined into a single state, which was not what should have happened had colonialism not interfered and decided everything had to be in neat little state lines.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a terrible famine caused by the war, which is really depicted in the book. We can see that with the rationing and then everyone's starvation.
I mean, once they're reaching the end of the book, like, at first their problems are in terms of, like, where they can be and avoiding bombs and avoiding conscription mm-hmm. and all of this. And then towards the end, as it gets further and further into the war, it's just, what are we eating? What can we eat? What are we going to eat?
And especially when they were surrounded and blockaded by the Nigerians. You can see this when Kanani winds up on the wrong side of that blockade.
Mm-hmm.
So that was when the famine was getting really, really bad. And that's going to lead into my next point, which is there are arguments that the war was a genocide against the Igbos, but no one has ever been prosecuted for it. So it's still a little bit of a gray line.
Okay.
Because it's a debate about if it can be considered a genocide if Nigeria was fighting to reclaim that territory and people. But at the same time, they were blockading, cutting off the food supplies.
Yeah.
So it's a very gray line that I don't feel I'm educated enough to give a yes or no one way or the other.
No. Maybe I could have if you asked me this question like 5 years ago, because I did take a genocide class in college.
By our college definition, maybe we could have. But so this is still an ongoing debate. And you can definitely see themes of this in the book as well.
Well, what kickstarts all of this is massacres of the Igbos.
Yes. And they had been persecuted prior, as seen in the book. So
that element is certainly there. Whether or not it fits like a legal definition is up in the air.
And I'm not trying to put words in Adichie's mouth whether she feels it was a genocide or not. But you can definitely see themes throughout the characters of that debate going on.
Yeah.
And finally, the president of Biafra did use conscription. This was very common. Youths were just kind of pulled off the street like Ugo was. And many did not return home, unfortunately.
That's the worst part to me.
It is. It is the worst part. It's really tragic. This book does a very illustrative job of depicting that conflict. Mm-hmm. And I think it was one of its strengths. And again, why I felt it kind of walked the line between the military war conflict and the interpersonal conflict.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you wanted less interpersonal.
Because the war sections were so strong, but there was, and this isn't like a tragedy porn, like, oh, I want to see more horrific events. This is just my opinions of what the strengths of
the book
were.
But you think that the book was trying to do that and it did it well and you could have used more.
I could have used more of that compared to the interpersonal stuff, which is where I felt the book really fell flat for me.
Okay. Okay.
All right. With that history, which I had a very interesting time researching because Nigeria is one of the countries you talk about in AP Comparative Government, which I self-studied and got a 5 on the exam on senior year.
I did not even know that that was an AP class that you could take.
Yeah. And then I had to fucking retake it because of the program I was in college. But anyway, yeah, it was really interesting. So I had knew a bit about the conflict, but not the details. And it's been many years. So, okay.
Well, thank you for all of your hard work.
Yeah.
Should we get into our star calculator from data scientist Ashley?
Oh, your new only roommate? Yes. Okay, Grace, would you like to tell us a bit more about our star calculator?
Yes. So data scientist Ashley, as Erin has kindly pointed out, my now only roommate, has kindly made this calculator for us to rate the books on a series of categories and then also compare to what we rate the books on StoryGraph, which we just do based on our vibes. So the 5 categories are historical accuracy, vibes, prose, originality, and characters.
Mm-hmm.
And for once, I have read this book long enough ago that I don't really remember what I rated it on StoryGraph.
I know, I'm pulling up my StoryGraph right now.
So it'll be interesting when we pull that up.
I can get us started. So for historical accuracy, I did give it a 4. It really stuck with me that she had gotten so much of this from personal accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really added a lot to the historical accuracy, and all the details about the war from my research all seemed to be very accurate. But I did feel like there were some gaps just in me putting together. Maybe it was like the timeline of events in the war. I felt I had some gaps there with historical accuracy. Vibes were 1. I think I went into this very negatively because I remembered not liking it. So I don't think I really gave myself a chance to change that opinion.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we don't do entirely books that we've read before on the pod.
It
but
just
especially
is
this season,
yeah.
Like with it being bestsellers, because we're so smart and so widely read,
so erudite,
that we would just really be limiting ourselves if we had a policy about that. Like,
yeah.
So far, I think we wouldn't have been able to read a single book we read this season if we didn't have that policy of, like, we can add this to the list if we read it before.
Yes. Prose, I gave it a 2. I thought there were some strengths, some parts where it felt kind of jumbled for me. Originality, a 4. Liked it. Liked the concept. Sorry, Grace is checking her dating app messages right now.
I am not.
And then for characters, a 1, because if I can't stand over half the characters, then sorry.
That's a 1.
Yeah. So that gives me a 2.4, and I rated this a 2 on StoryGraph.
Well, we are in tonight for a first on Fiverr Flop history, which is I gave historical accuracy a higher rating than Erin, and I'm giving it a 5.
Wow!
It does what I think a 5 needs to do, which is not only have accurate history, but represent it in a way that's important to the text and is not just like regurgitating. Like, it does something with the history, and I feel like this book does that. So I'm giving it a 5.
Wow.
Yes. So
that's such a rare five from Grace.
I know. I've given out like two, I think. Like I keep those fives for when, you know, for when you really deserve it. Vibes for, I just think this is a well-written book. And the main character, I think, is so exceptional. And I think that the story that they're telling is good and effective. Like, I didn't have the problems that you did with things like time skips. Mm-hmm. So, four. Pros, four. Same. I thought it was good and effective. Not, like, I'm not going to, I think, keep it in my head in the same category as I would, like, Isabel Allende. Mm-hmm. But it was good pros. Originality, five. Kind of this goes hand in hand almost with historical accuracy for me, which is this topic that needs to be written about more, and then writing about it with the combination of characters and that emotional versus like political plot mm-hmm. that she did. And then characters four, I put three here and then I backed it out and I put four.
Wow.
Because you're right, like I didn't really like Uga at all. And I thought Odenebo and Richard were really interesting characters to read about, even if I didn't enjoy them. And mm-hmm. then you know how I feel about the women. So I've decided, you know, that's not three material with okay. all of that in and of itself. That's four. So that's a 4.4. And I gave this a 4.25 on StoryCraft.
This might be our biggest discrepancy to date.
Honestly,
it's this or the Luminaries.
I was going to say, I think the Luminaries has edged it out, which is honestly crazy because I didn't even think that I felt that strongly about this book when reading it, but I do think coming out of it, like, I would recommend it to people.
No, the Luminaries, you gave a 4 and I gave a 2. And this one I gave a 2.4 and you gave a 4.4. They are
so it's
dead
tied.
Even. Wow.
Wow. Well, I think, honestly, the tiebreaker is that I think when you, like, are seething about something, the Luminaries would come to mind first.
Yeah, I think it's just the state
of
mind.
Long.
It was so long and the state of mind I was in was so not conducive to that book.
Okay. Well, yeah. All right. Well, I guess I lied a little bit earlier because I was like, well, we have a difference of opinion, but like not that much.
We have a pretty massive one.
I think we do. Like, I did not realize that I was going to give this book multiple fives in the calculator.
Yeah.
Nor that you were going to give it multiple ones.
Yeah, that's fair. So for me, this is a definitive flop, but for Grace,
it's a fine leaning five.
Yeah.
And I, like I said, I keep those fives close to my chest unless I actually give it a five. Like, I didn't give Snowflower a five. And that's, like, really up there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is a good one for me. I am so excited to get to the end of the season and compare our overall ranking lists.
Oh, my God. It's going to be pretty whack.
Because last season, I think with the exception of the Luminaries, we had things in a slightly different order, but they were generally in the same place.
I think it's going to be wildly
different.
This season,
it's going to be all over the place.
Next week is probably the book I've most been looking forward to talking about this whole time.
And by book, you mean audiobook.
And by book, I mean audiobook because I am a Libby girl. The Four Winds by Kristen Hannah.
Listen, everyone knew it was coming.
Everyone knew we were going to have Kristen Hannah this season. We will explain our choice in book next week.
Yes, but there is no way that we're doing a bestsellers season of a historical fiction podcast and we're not going to talk about Miss Kristen Hannah.
No. My queen, my icon, just to give you some spoilers. But in the meantime, make sure you're following us on social, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, FiverFlop_pod. Make sure you're following along our StoryGraph reading challenge for season 2.
And if you have any more general queries, you can email us at FiverFlopPodcast@gmail.com. And if you have any books that you think we should read, then you can go to the bios of any of our socials and fill out that recommendation form.
All right. And until next week,
happy reading.
Bye.